listener production.
They decide to go on a camping trip with their mates and they throw a rooftop tent on there and load it up with camping gear, head out of town, roll it and end up dead. One particular school's had six deaths from that type of scenario. So, avoidable.
Driving larger vehicles, something that a lot of people might need to do for work, can present some challenges if that isn't the vehicle that you have perhaps learned to drive in or that's your daily, and particularly when the car that you're regularly running in is very different to the work wheels. Perhaps it's a smaller car, but at work, you might be required to tow a trailer, for example, load up a ute or a four-wheel drive that will behave very, very differently when it's fully laden. How can you be best prepared to confidently and safely get the job done? Hi, I'm Rusty.
And I'm Lisa.
Welcome to another episode of Keep Your Wheels On, the podcast where you'll hear from real people talking about the mistakes that either resulted in them crashing the car or narrowly avoiding a situation that could have been much worse. And along the way, we'll be joined by experts to chat about how you can do your best to avoid ending up in a similar situation. Now, we'll get to today's guest, Graham Moat, very shortly. Today's episode theme, driving for work, when the job, I guess, requires us to drive a different vehicle, one that's unfamiliar to you.
A lot of people don't get the opportunity to be able to drive a range of vehicles. I mean, I was lucky enough, we had an automotive company growing up, so I had to drive anything and everything. But kids these days, they'll have one or two cars that they've ever had any experience in. And then, I mean, a lot of apprentices have to drive utes, load utes, backing trailers, all sorts of things that nobody's taught them to do in the past, but they're expected to do all of a sudden without any qualification or training.
And, I mean, I can recall one from within our industry. I don't know that it's necessarily related to our own network here, but some drivers with some promotional radio stuff, the A-frame trailers running about town, but no experience driving with a trailer, and an incident that ensued because of that.
Yeah, but how is somebody supposed to get experience doing that? You know, where do they get experience? Anybody can drive a trailer, but who teaches them? You know, and especially a young kid, an apprentice in a construction site, and he's told, oh, you've got to take that from here to there. You know, nearly every apprentice needs to have a license for their work, but they're not actually taught all the other things.
Most people on the job, particularly when it's small companies and so on, are required to do a variety of tasks, to be quickly adaptable, to get the job done and so on. But there is a little bit of a need here to just pause, understand what the vehicle is, what it's capable of when it's loaded up and so on, and what could happen for you when you're suddenly driving that work vehicle.
When it comes down to it, over 50% of workplace fatalities are on the road. That is a staggering amount of deaths. A lot of people have to drive a lot for their role, whether or not they're a salesperson or an apprentice or a tradie, whatever. If you're on the road a lot for your work, you really do need some proper training for your office. We're talking about your office is your actual car.
Today's guest's title is the head teacher for transport and logistics for TAFE New South Wales. Graham Moat, as we welcome you. You wear many more hats than that around this game, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely, Rusty. I've been in the heavy vehicle game for a very, very long time. Goes all the way back to my very first job when I was 14 years old, when I was doing driveway service. Not too many people remember what driveway service is all about anymore, but we used to have a lot of heavy vehicles come in, and I was just fascinated by the way that these guys would drive these things around and manoeuvre them in really tight spaces. And as I grew up and continued along my career path, I ended up becoming a mechanic and diving into the world of heavy vehicles. So I also wear a number of hats, including I'm the chief driving instructor for the Hills District in the New South Wales Rural Fire Service, for which I've been doing for many years now. And I'm also a specialist driver in the Australian Army, which I absolutely love.
Graham, can we firstly just broadly talk about, and I think Shane Jacobson in our first series of Keep Your Wheels On spoke about the need for motorists to be aware of heavy vehicles and how much longer it takes to stop in certain situations. So cutting them off is incredibly risky and so on. What are some overarching things about driving large vehicles when you're the person behind the wheel we should be mindful of?
as a driver of a heavy vehicle, I think the biggest issue we come across is people will talk about speed, people talk about fatigue, people talk about the use of drugs in the heavy vehicle industry. The biggest issue I find is complacency. People get behind the wheel, they've been driving for many, many years, and they're complacent around other road users, the errors that other road users can make, the types of roads that we're driving on, and the types of vehicles and road conditions that we can face whilst we're travelling out there in the big wide world.
Graeme, tell us about your program and why it focuses on driving that people might need to do around their job, their occupation, their work.
Yeah, Rusty, one of the biggest programs we have run at TAFE New South Wales is here in Sydney, we started the Sydney Metro project, which is still going. It's a beautiful project linking all parts of Sydney via an underground driverless train. Now, sitting down with the project managers of the Sydney Metro project, we determined that heavy vehicle movements were a major risk because of the large amount of heavy vehicle movements to literally get dirt out of the ground and deliver it to somewhere else outside of Sydney. We decided that we would build a program, and it was a one-day program that every single driver on the project had to do. Some had been driving for 5 minutes, some had been driving for longer than I'd been around, but it was an opportunity for everybody to stop, take check of what they were doing, think about the consequences of the decisions that they make on the road, and also teach them a little something that they may or may not have known. What are we now, 6 years into the project, and we haven't had one driver-related fatality on that particular project. So I'm really proud of it, and I'm really proud of the work that we've done with Sydney Metro.
Well done. That's a great example. What about other kind of roles or jobs where young drivers are, you know, asked to operate vehicles with either trailers or heavy loads? I mean, you've talked about, you know, removing dirt there in the example of the Metro and so on, but I mean, it could be perhaps semi-trailers that are delivering food or something along those lines. And there are some, you know, major thoroughfares, if you like, where that's required, transportation of goods and so on.
It's funny you say that, Rusty. At TAFE New South Wales, we have what we call a mobile training unit program. We roughly have 460 trailers within the TAFE New South Wales fleet. And they range from a whole heap of things, from single axle box trailers all the way through to drop down to the ground, 4.5 ton dual axle mobile hairdressing studios. The whole point of the program was that teachers, mainly in the regional areas, could literally put trailers onto the back of vehicles and drive them to wherever they need to do for course delivery. It wasn't until we started the program that we thought, we're asking teachers to drive with trailers of various sizes, various weights. What do they know about trailers?
Mm.
What do they understand about weights? What do they understand about load distribution? What do they understand about trailer sway? What do they understand about the legalities of using a trailer? We thought, well, hang on a minute, we are really putting our people at risk. And we put together another training program, which consisted of a whole heap of theory based, these are your rights, these are your responsibilities, this is what trailers can and can't do, this is how you understand weights, gross trailer mass, aggregate trailer mass. This is a whole heap of things around load restraint, load distribution, and this is why trailer sway happens. Then we put them out into the TAFE campuses and we taught them how to drive with trailers. We've had 340 staff members put through that program, and again, zero fatalities. It's pertinent to understand that heavy vehicles are one part of driving for work, but we've also got light vehicles that anyone can just jump behind the wheel that has a C-class license and drive away. Could be with a trailer. It could be a ute with a whole heap of loads on the back.
Mm.
What are you putting on the back? It's not as simple as that.
Before we move on here, just explain what trailer sway is.
So trailer sway is a situation where the trailer starts to move faster than the tow vehicle. And what will happen is the trailer will start to drive left and right as you're driving along. And in the blink of 5 to 6 seconds, that trailer sway can become so dramatic that it will actually flip the trailer and the car and can lead to some very, very serious consequences. That can happen for a number of reasons. It can happen because of external weather situations, crosswinds. It could happen because of speed, the way that the vehicle is loaded, too much weight towards the rear of the trailer rather than putting it centrally over the axle set, or it could just be bad maintenance. Predominantly, we find a lot of trailer sway issues happen out there on the road around heavy vehicles. People in with trailers, caravans and the like decide that a heavy vehicle's driving along will overtake them, and they don't understand the wind aerodynamics and the changes that happens. Next thing you know, you get a massive crosswind just taking over the trailer, and yeah, it gets worse from there.
And also, I mean, for literally every apprentice, I mean, other than a hairdressing apprenticeship, all other apprentices really do need their vehicles and need licenses for work, yet they're not taught how to. A ute, for example, it's a lot lighter if it hasn't got a load compared to when it's got a load. How to load that vehicle, you know, whether or not they're plumbers, carpenters, all these kids actually need to learn a lot more information around driving for work.
Could not agree more. I think that if you pull into any TAFE campus across New South Wales that runs a carpentry course, a building course, plumbing, any sort of trade-related course, the car park will be absolutely chock-a-block full of utes in various stages of loaded and unloaded conditions. And you can guarantee that none of those people driving those vehicles has any sort of formal training around what could and couldn't happen.
For young people listening, will a job ever ask them to maybe use their own car for work, and does kind of insurance get messy and so on? I mean, some of those things do they need to be mindful of?
Quite often employers will definitely ask them to use their own car.
Yeah, absolutely. And here lies the problem. We all know that insurance companies are the first people to jump up and down and look for ways to not pay out claims. You're using your personal vehicle that's insured for personal reasons, for business reasons. That'll be the first one.
So this is really now starting to open up a whole raft of things for you to think about if you are going to be driving potentially for work. Now, our guest on this episode today is someone who works with young drivers every day and has seen firsthand why it's important that they understand the types of vehicles that they're driving.
G'day, I'm Murray, and I'm the team leader of a learner driver mentoring program. So the person that taught me to drive a car was my next door neighbour, and he was also a teacher at my high school. My first driving lesson was pretty scary. It was in the city and I'd only ever driven on the farm or on country roads. So what was going through my mind on my first driving lesson in the city was that there was just too much happening out there. There was other cars and there were things to look out for, like stop signs and give way signs and that sort of stuff. So it was pretty scary stuff. During my driving life, I've had to drive for work on a number of occasions. One of them was when, obviously, 19 and driving a police car. So I was a police officer in New Zealand and we had to undergo driver training. I didn't have any issues driving a police car because damaging one would have required a lot of paperwork, so you're always pretty careful with them. Although we did get involved in some high-speed chases, and I think it was just more good luck than good management that we didn't wrap one around a tree or something like that. What got me into the work I do today was that I've been involved in road safety for about 24 years, and the program to help disadvantaged people get their on-road skills takes young people in, and we have to get their P license. They start at low-risk areas and build on that to high-risk driving, and so it's competency and skills-based rather than based around hours, but we put young people through to be competent drivers. For a young person to have their licence in a place like Townsville particularly is very important because we don't have a good public transport system, and for anyone going into a trade-related industry, they're going to have to drive work vehicles at some stage in their career to get further ahead. Any of the trades like carpentry, plumbing, electrical, and also a lot of the mining jobs involve driving utes and that sort of stuff. The sorts of things that they need to be aware of is that driving a work vehicle is different than getting your licence in a Toyota Yaris or a Hyundai i30. It's got a higher centre of gravity, and towing trailers and loading them up, and that it's very important to know more about it than an ordinary car. Yeah, towing a trailer for the first time would be an experience for a young person, I'd say, because it's something that you only ever learn, I guess, by doing it lots and lots of times. So the first couple of times, you're going to be unaware of all that, how to get your car to manoeuvre the trailer behind you. I think there should be lots more training. I mean, just not even for a work vehicle. If you go back to the Hyundai i30 and then you can go out in a couple of years' time and buy a Ford Ranger, there's a lot of difference between those two vehicles. The stopping distances is different, and that would be a shock to a lot of young people if they were driving a ute and had to brake without knowing that the stopping distance was going to be different. The centre of gravity is different as well, so, you know, there's more chance of a rollover even on a bitumen road because you've cornered and braked at the same time or something like that. Yeah, that, the other sorts of things.
Murray mentioned their trailers and heavy loads. You've talked, Graham, about trailer sway. What risks are there with this being introduced to young workers, and how do we let them know what is possible experientially? How can they learn that?
Yeah, Rusty, it's really hard to teach people around the risks associated with driving when they haven't really experienced it themselves. Mm. It's a really horrible way to go about it. You don't want anyone to have to experience something negative and then learn from that, because the consequences could be way worse than just a learning motion. Trailer sway is something that absolutely scares the hell out of me. I've felt it before, and I've seen the consequences of trailer sway. One of the biggest bridges that we have between Sydney and Newcastle here in New South Wales, the Moonee Moonee Bridge, it dips down. It's a long bridge. It's very windy. It has windsocks at each end. And this particular day I was coming along, the windsocks were facing different directions, which means that the wind was going down one way, coming back on the other side of the bridge. We were traveling along. I was a passenger in the vehicle at the time. I was a ute, three cars in front with a caravan on the back, small caravan, going way too fast for those particular conditions. Hmm. Trailer sway happened, and the first thing he did was hit the brakes. Now, as I mentioned earlier, trailer sway is when the trailer is travelling faster than the tow vehicle. The last thing you want to do is hit the brakes. Now, you're actually slowing the tow vehicle down initially, and the trailer sway becomes worse. So that's what he did. The ute went over, bounced off its roof, ended up back on its feet. The caravan sheared away from the ute, rolled three or four times and was just splinters. I was first on scene, and I was expecting to be covering dead bodies. Three occupants, a father and two small children, literally got out, walked out of this ute, absolutely dumbfounded as to what had happened. And I will always remember that particular day. It didn't happen to me, but that vision of what I saw absolutely keeps me in check when I'm towing. Mm. It's not something that I want anyone else to have to go through, but I really want people to learn from my experience.
Even to Murray's comment about, you know, a smaller Hyundai versus a larger four-wheel drive dual cab ute kind of thing. I mean, there's quite a difference between those two vehicles and what they might behave like and react like and so on. How important is it, particularly around work scenarios like this, that we train people appropriately for the vehicles that they are likely to be called upon to use for their job?
Rusty, I think we're moving in the right direction. I really do. I think that workplaces are now starting to understand that if they're giving vehicles to people and saying, hook the trailer up and off you go, or just off you go, those days are long gone. Induction processes need to happen and competency needs to happen. If something goes wrong, heaven forbid something goes wrong, it's no use turning around, because the coroner is going to be the first person to say, what training did this guy have in driving this vehicle? How did you instruct him on how to operate this vehicle? It's no different from operating a forklift or operating any other piece of machinery. Just because it's a car makes no difference. And we're getting better at it, but we do need to do a lot more.
Has that training you've been doing been effective? I mean, it sounds like it has been.
I've had drivers that have been driving for over 50 years come up to me and say, Graham, we need to make sure that courses like this go into our learner licensing programs. I've had very experienced drivers and some not so experienced drivers. I've had tears. There's a range of emotions that come across people when they're actually looking at what the real consequences are of the decisions they're making behind the wheel. People don't understand what the consequences are, and this is where complacency comes into effect.
You know, government services and large corporates will do some training courses like Graham does, but a vast majority of employers, especially when you're talking your trades, they don't have the capacity or the time to be training their staff in trailers, in for utes or whatever. And these kids are expected to drive their own vehicles to different sites throughout the day with and without equipment on their utes. And there can be all sorts of different issues that they have to face that they've never faced before and they haven't been trained for.
The other point that we need to really think about is these people that are driving for work, driving trucks that have been deregistered down to 4.5 ton gross vehicle mass, which means you can drive them on a car license. So you're driving a truck, a small truck on a car license. And all we're doing is handing them the keys saying, okay, well, off we go. We're going to this place. See you there. And that's just crazy. That's a recipe for disaster.
How many young drivers do you think are, you know, finding themselves in that unfamiliar driving situation because of their job? And can a young worker maybe lose their job if they refuse to drive something that they're uncomfortable with?
Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people around the country. I could name a dozen off the top of my head that are in that exact situation. We need to spend more time inducting our people before they drive our vehicles, making sure that they can actually do what you think they can do.
Yeah.
I mean, how many apprentices go through per year? I mean, that would be the indication of how many people are asked to drive different equipment than they're comfortable with or that they've been taught on for their work.
There's thousands of them. And so you speak to employers and the answers are all the same. I don't have time. I can't afford it. Really?
Mm.
What about how much time is it going to take if the reverse is true? How much money are you going to lose if the reverse is true? It's a small investment in your people. Oh, but what if I train them up and they leave? Well, what if you don't train them and they stay?
Yeah, and we don't want to lose lives. That's the most important thing here. Murray's seen the very real impacts in his career of young drivers not being aware of the difference that they might face driving a larger vehicle. So let's hear about some of what he's seen.
We've got a local trade school here and people are in grade 11 and 12 doing trades as well as school work, and they've just got their licence, so to speak, their P licence, and because they're tradies, they go out and buy a Toyota dual cab or one of those utes and they load it up with their toolbox, and then they decide to go on a camping trip with their mates and they throw a rooftop tent on there and load it up with camping gear, head out of town. 5 minutes out of town, they're mixing with B doubles and B triples on the 110 k an hour highway, and they're heading out bush for the weekend, and they hit a gravel road and roll it and end up dead. I mean, we've had a couple of incidences, or more than a couple, I think over the last 6 or 7 years, this one particular school's had 6 deaths from that type of scenario. 6 people who probably have 100 friends and family that when they sit down for Christmas dinner this year, there'll be an empty space there. And that's the trauma of it, not just for the friends and family, but for the first responders that have to deal with this. We're talking about real incidences, people that went out for a fun weekend and never came home because they were driving on roads that they weren't used to and driving a vehicle that they weren't used to. Yeah, that's probably the one that sticks in my head. Red P-plater. Or the young fella going home after work had dropped someone off on his way, and again on a country road, never put his seatbelt on, and they think that he got blinded by the lights of an oncoming car, went off the road, was an unlit area, and hit an embankment, again, killed himself. And I think young people don't realise that driving a ute is going to take them another 6 or 8 metres to stop compared to a car.
This is some very, very poignant stuff here from Murray. And I think if you're listening and you're wondering, you know, does this really apply to me, or how hard can it be? I'm just jumping in a four-wheel drive to get to wherever I want to go, or camping with my mates. And if you think that can't happen to me, you are wrong. You need to stop and ask yourself, am I comfortable driving this vehicle? Do I really understand what it can do in certain circumstances? And just because a road-going four-wheel drive is a slight step up from what you might be, you know, behind the wheel of on a daily basis, don't think it doesn't perform differently. He talked there, Graeme, about stopping distances, for example. Stopping distances for larger, for laden vehicles are naturally longer. They take longer to stop, don't they?
Absolutely. It's a simple discussion about physics. You can't stop something that weighs 65 tons quicker than you can stop something that weighs 2 tons. It just doesn't work, and no matter how good the braking system is.
Mm.
It's poignant listening to Murray's story. There's so many of those situations around the country every single day, and it really is heart-wrenching to think that people are making these decisions, but they're selfish, selfish decisions. They're getting behind the wheel of a vehicle that A, they don't know, B, they don't understand, C, they're not ready to drive, but they're still doing it. Mm. And they're not thinking about something that Murray said, which really rings true, is what about the people around you? The ripple effect. So you're selfish enough to do something that you're not comfortable doing without speaking up, and something goes wrong. You've now affected the ones that love you the most. You've now affected the first responders. You've now affected the nursing staff, the doctors at the hospital, and the ripple effect goes on and on and on. We had an incident, a road safety incident, not far from my home, and my nephew was affected by that incident because he went to school with somebody that played soccer with the next door neighbor of the cousin from that person. So we're talking 7-8 degrees of separation.
Mm.
But because there was a connection, my nephew was affected by it. So imagine how many people were affected in between that. That's where people need to stand up and say, no. It's okay to say no. It really is, because the consequences of not saying no are just drastic.
Just to reiterate something that Graeme has said there, it's not only you speaking up, right? It also has to be the chorus of those around you. So whether it's workmates or friends or whatever, they too need to not be afraid to step up and say, hey, are we okay to be doing this? Are we accredited? Are you comfortable driving this? How much experience have you got for it? You too should also be speaking up.
The three of us, we're all parents. I mean, there would not be a worse scenario than getting that call or that police come to your door to tell you that your son or daughter isn't coming home. But for those kids, the onus shouldn't really be on them, because you don't know what you don't know. So when they don't know the difference between driving that Hyundai i30 to a ute or whatever else, they just think it's another car. It's got a steering wheel, pedal set, just like anything else I've driven. They actually genuinely aren't taught the differences. So, I mean, why would you think it's much different?
But that kind of leads us to that whole point, doesn't it? What should anybody who's got to drive for work make sure that they've done, Graeme, in relation to paperwork before they sit behind the wheel? What sort of things should they do?
In the Army, we have a really good program. It's very simple. It's a familiarisation program. And, you know, doesn't matter how long you've been driving for, if it's a vehicle that you haven't driven before, you aren't allowed to drive until you've done some sort of a familiarisation program with it. And it is simple as a driving assessor going over it with you, and you're looking at things like the first aid kit, how to pop the bonnet, where the tyre change equipment is, where the fire extinguisher is, where the indicators are. Very simple stuff about driving. And then it's a quick little lap around the block to make sure that the person that will be driving that vehicle is comfortable with what they're doing. And I think that is an awesome process that we just don't do outside of the Army in the civilian world. And I don't know why. I don't know why we continue to give keys to people without even asking a question. Have you driven this before? And people getting behind the wheel, they then start to feel uncomfortable. But because for a gamut of reasons, they don't know what the consequences could be if they don't drive the vehicle, or if they do speak up, they don't.
What are the first steps that a young driver should take after they're perhaps involved in an accident while driving a work vehicle? What's the things they should be doing?
The first thing they need to do is render any assistance if required. And, you know, it might be single vehicle, multiple vehicle, whatever the case may be. If you're okay, then render assistance. The second thing is make sure that the scene is safe. Too many times I see people have small little rear enders on major highways, and then everyone just gets out of the vehicle, starts walking around, taking photos, exchanging details, pull off the road and do all that sort of stuff off the highway. You're putting yourselves in harm's way. Definitely exchange details and let the insurance company know exactly what's going on, but make a call to your boss. Give your boss the opportunity to either A, steer you on what the company process is, and also B, turn up to the scene to give you any emotional assistance that you may need, and or take you to the hospital or a doctor or whatever the case may be.
You mentioned the degrees of separation there before. I mean, the potential impacts physically and financially for a driver in these incidents can be quite significant, but let alone how it can knock them around for their future too. Psychologically, it can be quite a difficult thing, can't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are plenty of people out there that I know of that don't drive for that very reason. They've been involved in a near miss, in a situation, and they've said, no, it's not for me. I'm happy to take public transport. They don't want to face the repercussions of what could happen.
Now, Murray believes the answer to this is a graduated licensing system. And that's something that Graham, I think, is clearly in support of too, where drivers get experience in vehicles of all sizes. So let's circle back to Murray as we wrap up the episode.
It's important to me to have a good graduated licensing system where young people, the other people that are our future builders, our future care workers, whatever, we need to give them the best chance of staying alive on the roads. I mean, a lot of that stuff about loading vehicles, knowing the centre of gravity of a vehicle, knowing stopping distances of vehicles, knowing how to drive on dirt or gravel roads is information that we know about, but we don't give it to young people. Driving is probably one of the most dangerous things that we learn in our life. We have all this knowledge about how dangerous it is mixing with B doubles and B triples, driving at 110k an hour, and even the testing doesn't test that sort of stuff. We need to, in my opinion, revise the whole licensing system so if young people don't get to drive under those different conditions, then they at least have the opportunity to do it through simulators. If you're going to have a graduated licensing system, it's not just graduated till you've finished your green peas, it's graduated all the way through. So if you're buying a certain class of vehicle, you need to know how to drive that vehicle before you're allowed to drive it. I mean, they're talking Australia-wide at the moment, the number of young people that are going out there and buying caravans post-COVID and saying they need to get licensed. If they need to get licensed driving a caravan, towing a caravan, surely they need to get licensed towing a jet ski trailer or a trailer or buying a Ram or a Ranger and driving that. The class of car that you get your license in should be the class of car you're licensed to drive, until you can prove otherwise, in my opinion. If you're talking about work situations, the employer has got an obligation to make sure that you're a safe driver if you're driving their vehicles, not just for the economic costs, but for the safety cost. Don't do it. Tell your boss that you need some lessons in it, or at least have someone who's got the experience sitting beside you. Become a learner again, I guess, and admit that you're going to the next level. You've got to do some work to get there. Well, I'd say to the employers, you have an obligation to make sure that that person is skilled enough to drive that vehicle. So you've got an obligation to drive around a couple of blocks with them, you know, and make sure that they know what it is, make sure they understand the stopping distance is going to be different, that the turning circle is going to be bigger, that the centre of gravity is at a different level. And as an employer, I believe you've got an obligation to do that. Out of the national road toll, I think, which is about 1,200 or something, a third of those are young people. It's just madness. So avoidable.
Firstly, how should training for work-related driving be altered, in your opinion?
It needs to be an induction type of process. The WHS legislation says that the PCBU is responsible for the worker's safety at work. When we go to a construction site, they've got hard hats on, steel cap boots, safety glasses, full restraint harnesses. But yet when we, as an employer, we ask them to drive from site to site, we don't worry about road safety. Like, that just absolutely blows me away. So we need to have a mandated induction process for the different type of vehicles that we're actually asking to drive. So if something does go wrong, we can quite comfortably turn around and say, well, we were comfortable with what they were doing because of their training and induction.
We've talked about this from an employer perspective. Let's go the employee, right? What can young drivers do to better prepare themselves for what might be expected of them in their job behind the wheel like this?
I implore all people to go out and get some extra training, driver training, be it in a small light vehicle, in a larger light vehicle, in a heavy vehicle. Go out and get some training. You will spend most of your life behind the wheel in some way, shape or form, whether it be for work, whether it be for relaxation or just as a mode of transport. We take driving for granted. Let's stop that cycle. Let's go out and get some further training, learn some more skills so you get better prepared for whatever it is that you end up doing.
Lisa, final thought from you and the importance of what Graham spoke about before, not being afraid to speak up, not being afraid to say no in certain circumstances.
I mean, when you first get into any car, it's about that cabin familiarisation, making the car work for you, sort out all your mirrors, your vision, your everything, but feel comfortable in it. If you're not comfortable, you've got to actually speak up and tell somebody, because you're driving a one-ton lethal weapon. And without the right training, or if you're feeling anxious or uncomfortable in that scenario, you need to stop and work out why you're not comfortable and actually get some help.
Most people in their daily lives do jobs that require a level of certification or training, and it really should be the same when there is a requirement for them to drive a vehicle on our roads. And if you're listening today and you're perhaps thinking, well, this is red tape gone wrong, it's all about ensuring that those young people return to their families at the end of the workday, Graham, because we've given them the right set of safe skills to do the job, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's all about getting home safe. We all have that right.
Thank you very much for joining us on the pod today and for sharing some of the insights. Can we quickly get you to give a plug for what you're doing and where young people can perhaps find out more about the sort of training that you and TAFE New South Wales offer?
Yeah, Rusty, we offer a number of programs around the state tailored to specific people, but jump on the TAFE New South Wales website, have a look for our Certificate 3 in Driving Operations. It's a new course that we're starting this year, hoping to encourage a lot of people to up their skills.
Well done.
I love your work, Graham.
On the next episode of Keep Your Wheels On, it's something that you'll often see if you keep an eye on the cars around you, or if they're maybe stopped at the lights, or it could even be the reason why a car is veering all over the roads. This is a big one. Using mobile phones and how dangerous it is while behind the wheel.
I looked up just in time to see it happening, and I was essentially a passenger in the situation at that point. Like, I think I hit the brakes, but essentially what stopped me was the car in front.
And we'll chat with Alex from AccuSensus, who knows firsthand the impact that using a mobile phone while driving can have and what his company's doing about it.
James was run over and killed back in 2013. Somebody ran to him from behind who was impaired and texting. So it's one of the things that led to AccuSensus being founded.
I'm Rusty.
And I'm Lisa.
And this is Keep Your Wheels On. Keep Your Wheels On is a listener production brought to you in partnership with My Drive School. Hosted by me, Greg Rust, and Lisa Scaife. Audio production by Kelly Fulston. An executive producer is Todd Stevens.
A podcast funded by the Australian Government and supported by Repco Authorised Service.
Listener.